Good afternoon. Today is March 22nd, 2018, and we're at the home of Ruth and Larry Natman. I am Terry Spires, and I'm here with Ruth. We appreciate her coming and sharing her time with us and being part of the Raven Landing Resident Stories Project and University Archives. Can we start with a little biographical information? Maybe where you were born and when?
Okay. I was born during the Depression years on an Iowa farm, a farm that has now been in the family for over seven generations. And it has a lot of history and a lot of memories and fondness for me. But I was in fifth grade as a nine-year-old when I first read about Alaska, and that's when I decided I wanted to come here. So I set my goal to get my education and then apply for a job here, which is what I ended up doing, but in a kind of a long way around to do it. When I was a senior, the seniors were bused to the county seat for what they call Career Day, and we could choose two different places that we were interested in to go to hear what the requirements were and have questions answered and all. So the first one I went to was in soil conservation. And there was, of course, a man that was teaching, and I was the only girl in there. "What are you doing in here?" he said. "Well," I said, "I have an interest in working out of doors and laying contours and terraces, so I'm interested in doing that kind of thing." "Well, there's no place for a girl, so the only place if you want to work in that field, then you'll have to be a secretary in the office." And that was the last thing I wanted to do. Of course, back then, we weren't bold enough to speak up and say, "Okay, I'm still interested in this." Now, in this day and age, I would, but that's... But that back there, we didn't do that. And especially, we never talked back to a teacher, and we never talked back to a man. So then the second one I went to was nursing, because I was interested in nursing. And then I learned I had to be 18 before I could enter nursing school. And I was going to graduate at 16. And so what am I going to do with my 2 years? If we would have had counselors back then, the counselor would advise, go ahead and go to school and get your chemistry and those requirements out of the way, and then transfer to your nursing school. But I wasn't told that. So, okay, what can I do with 2 years? And at that time, you could take 18 semester hours, which is quite a heavy load when I think back at it, for 2 years, and you could get to an AA degree in elementary education and get your Iowa State Teaching's License. And I was interested in young children, so that was kind of a natural, too. So I did that. And I had to borrow money to go to college, and I thought I couldn't leave the state of Iowa until I had my debt repaid. It may be that my parents told me that so that I wouldn't leave for Alaska right away. I don't really know. And so I did take a teaching job, lived very frugally, and saved my money and paid off my debt. And... then I was ready to apply for a teaching job here in Alaska. Well, a young man proposed, and I said, "No, thank you, I'm going to Alaska." He said, "Great, I'd like to go to Alaska too." So we got married, and then after we got married, he changed his mind and decided to go to graduate school first. So I worked to put him through 3 years of graduate school at the University of Colorado. And then the Army drafted us and took us to Georgia. And so the dream was put off. And then the babies come along, you know. And we were living in Sacramento, California, when he received a job offer to teach math at the University of Alaska. And I said, "Aha, I don't care what you do, but I'm going." I'm going. So we drove up the Alaska Highway in a Volkswagen microbus, and that's a story in itself, with three children. The two youngest were babies in diapers, and that's before the days of Pampers. And, of course, we had to go by way of Iowa because grandparents were convinced we were going to the end of the world and they would never see their grandchildren again. So we drove up the Alaska Highway putting up a tent every night. None of it was paved then, so it would be either really muddy or really dusty, and you'd see dust coming from miles away, and we just pulled over to the side of a safe place and sat there until the truck went by and the dust would settle. But every night we were setting up a tent, and I was cooking a dinner over a campfire. And then after we got that dinner cleaned up, then I was heating water and hand-washing baby diapers. And so you can guess what I wanted first when we got to Fairbanks, right?
Go wash it dry.
You're right. The first stop was a laundromat. And then I was looking forward to having a real bath. So our second stop was a motel out on the College Road. and it had a bathtub, and I ran water, and then I wasn't sure I wanted to put my babies into it. I wasn't expecting brown water.
Oh.
I had read about the big cabbages and the high cost of living and a lot of things in Alaska, but I don't remember reading about brown water. Well, we had a hard time finding a place to rent. We were told that there was housing on campus, but when we got here, we learned that it was only for you were on a point system. The more children you had, the more points you got. The more years you had taught at the university, the more points you got. In my opinion, it was just backwards that it should be for the new arrival faculty, and then they until they learned the community and where they wanted to buy a house or what have you. But that isn't the way they did it back in those years. And and there were no vacancies at any of the apartment buildings. One of the most popular ones was the place that used to sit here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I can't even think what it was called now, but it's long gone, and they had no vacancies. There were no ads in the newspapers. And so I literally just drove up and down roads until I saw a vacant house on Fairbanks Street, and there were three little houses there. And I looked in the window, and they had building materials stacked in the house, but it was obviously not being lived in. So I found out who owned it, and then went to visit the owner and talked him into moving his supplies out and renting it to us. The bathroom was so dirty. I mean, it was obvious that the workers used it, but no one ever cleaned it. And so that was my first chore. And we had brown water there. And that was because of the well is drilled through permafrost, which you can get to a water table, but it remains so cold that you get the brown water, and sometimes you get vegetable material in it too. The water tested safe, but it didn't look very appealing. So we got used to things like brown shirts, brown diapers, and brown underwear. And before we go back to Iowa to visit the grandparents, we'd stop at Penny's and buy new underwear to take with us. And then, of course, it was a little harder getting used to brown mashed potatoes, so I would just make more brown gravy. And we did carry water from Fox Springs for our drinking water. And that is how I got to Alaska and about my first family. I did lose my previous husband to cancer some years ago. And after his burial and all, I learned about beginning experience for people who had lost the love of, through death, divorce, mm-hmm. separation, or whatever, whether it's a spouse, a children, siblings, or parents. And so I did go there. We rented a space from the Catholic Church, and they'd assign a couple rooms to the women and a couple rooms to the men, and we'd take our sleeping bags, and they had volunteers that came in to prepare our meals, and we were there from Friday evening until Sunday evening, and were led by trained facilitators through all the stages of death, the denial, the loss of faith in others, the anger, the loss of faith in God, and so forth. And although that's where I met Larry, that didn't mean anything to me. I was not looking for another husband. And when he called to go cross-country skiing a couple months later, I said, "Larry who?" He never let me forget that. So he had to tell me where we met. And then unbeknownst to each other, we had both volunteered to be trained facilitators for the next weekend. They'd have about 3 weekends a year. And so we were meeting then every Monday night with the others that were being trained as facilitators. And we learned that we were more and more had things in common. And but we were told, no, you should not, you're too vulnerable, so you don't date and marry somebody that you meet in beginning experience. And I can understand where they're coming from. Actually, it was Larry's son that proposed to me first. He was he was the manager of Traveler's Inn, which at that time was the largest hotel in Fairbanks. And the university would have their waltz night there with the symphony orchestra. And it was a fundraiser for the symphony orchestra. So Larry invited me to go on a date with he and double date with his son and his son's wife. And so we did. And Larry's a good dancer, by the way. That was another plus, as far as I was concerned. But his son got me out on the dance floor, too, and said, "We've never seen our father as happy as been since you came into his life. We hope you become our stepmother." What a young man ever says that to women. That was a surprise. But still, that didn't lead any place. Then Thanksgiving, Larry took me down to Arizona to meet his family. And the first night, well, I hit it off with his parents very well, but the first night, his mother and I stayed up until 2 o'clock in the morning talking like two schoolgirls. She was thrilled to know that I made my own clothes, as she did, and she was thrilled to know that I was into genealogy because she was trying to trace her family history. And she said, "Make Larry marry you. Make Larry marry you." So there's proposal number two, but I hadn't had a proposal from Larry. And I told her, I said, "Well, I think I'm ready to say yes if and when he proposes, but I'm not going to push him into it." "Oh, well, he'll just use you. He'll let you do his laundry and cooking for you." And I said, "Mom," I didn't know, I didn't say Mom. I called her Mrs. Knappman at that point. I said, "You do not know your son. He is not that kind of a man." And it was another full year before Larry proposed. But I knew when he did that he meant it for the life, and I didn't have to worry about this going to be a trial and error kind of thing or anything. It was something that was meant to be.
So once you got up here, did you work?
Oh, yes. In fact, that's what I came for. My degree, well, I had my BA degree in elementary education, and then I went back to school and finished my BA with a double major. My first husband was discharged from the Army. He took a job back at Central College, Pella, Iowa, which is where I got my AA degree. And I signed up for substitute teaching since school had already started and I couldn't get a teaching job. And Pella Christian High, I thought that if you have a teaching certificate, well, you can teach anything. So I was teaching band and typing and history and religion then they called me right after Thanksgiving and said, "Well, our home ec teacher just threw up her hands and walked out. I'd like for you to come in and meet the school board tonight." So I did go in and meet the school board, and there were two other girls there, both of whom I knew. Both were graduate home economists, had their BA degrees in home economics. And so the next morning when I got a call saying that the school board would offer me the contract, I argued over the phone. I said, "Well, those other two girls had their degrees in home economics, and mine is just elementary education." They said, "But you are the only one of the three that is married. You had 9 years as a 4-H, so you have a background. And most of our girls get married right out of high school, so we think that you're better prepared for teaching the home ec classes than those two girls." So I did take the job. I enjoyed it so much. So in the next spring when they offered me the next year, I said, "No, I'm going to go back to school and finish my junior and senior year and get my degree." They said, "That's fine. You go ahead and sign up for your classes. And where you've got empty spots, then we'll put in your courses here." So I ended up doing my junior and senior year with teaching as well. And I had a 2-year-old child at that point. So I was raising a child, taking care of a husband, going to school full time. And I did get my BA degree in home economics. And then I did some work when I was in Colorado while I was working to put my husband through, and I did take a few courses there toward my master's degree. And then when I got to Fairbanks, I had my job that I got in Fairbanks was with the home ec department at the university when we had a home ec department. And my specialty field was early childhood education, and that's what I got my master's degree in. And then when they wiped out the home ec department, I started my own private preschool called Young Learners, which I had for 17 years. And then when my Young Learners started bringing their preschoolers to me, I said, "There's something wrong with this picture." So that's when I sold my business and started a step-on tour guide service, which I have done now for 35 years. It's for bus companies that drive up from the lower 48 or from Canada who want somebody local to tell them the history of Fairbanks and show them the sights. Well, that's what I do. I step on the bus and I tell the driver where to go, quite literally. And I've enjoyed very much sharing Alaska with our tourists. Not only was I a tour guide, but I worked quite often too as an escort and did the planning for 2 weeks for their tour in Alaska and the Yukon. So I would give them guided tours in Alaska and in Yukon and Dawson and Dempster Highway. And it brought a lot of interesting experiences.
I can imagine. Can you maybe tell us what some of your fondest memories are of your life?
Fondest memories. You know, The earliest memories that you have are ones that are dramatic, and usually they're negative. And that's what I come up with. In fact, I was just mentioning someone yesterday that I remember telling my mother, I remember sitting on a blanket on a house that had big columns, like between a living room and dining room, and you and Daddy were going out the door carrying a little pail with a spout on it, and I remember being very upset and crying. And Mother says, I can't believe you remember that. And it was your great-grandparents' home, and we had taken you down there to stay with her grandpa and grandma while your Daddy and I went to the store to get kerosene for the kerosene lamps. And she couldn't believe I remembered that. I neither could I, actually, because my first real memory was when on my fourth birthday, when an aunt and uncle came out to the farm for my birthday. And it had a happy bit to it, but the negative was that as a four-year-old, one of my chores was to carry water out to the hens. And so it was a big old milk can, stainless steel milk, not a milk can, but a milk bucket. And they were heavy, and I, of course, couldn't carry it full. So I would just put it on the pump and pump it to the point where I could carry it. And so it meant several trips to the hen house, but that's another story. Well, in any case, this slipped off of the well and landed on my foot. And as farm kids, you didn't wear shoes in the summertime except to church. You had two pairs of shoes. One was your good ones that you wore to church, and one was your ones you wore to school. And then the next year, you would get one pair of shoes that when you outgrew them, maybe you outgrew them before you actually stopped wearing them, but then you'd have a new pair. That would be your shoes for the next year. And so in the summertime, we went shoeless. And of course, one of the reasons was because leather was rationed and you had to make more shoes last. And so it landed on my bare foot and split my toenail, and it was bleeding like a stuffed pig. And my Aunt Elsie picked me up and carried me into the kitchen and set me in the kitchen sink to wash it off. And that was a thrill to me because my baby sister could have her baths in the kitchen sink. But no, Ruth, you're too big for the kitchen sink. And I thought, but Aunt Ethel, Aunt Elsie doesn't think I'm too big for the kitchen sink. So that was the positive
that's
about
a, that's
it.
That's a fun memory, isn't it?
Can you tell us about how you came to be at Raven Landing?
Yes, I... Larry and I actually were on the committee from day one, almost, from the planning, long before we ever really got any land or anything. So we were in the planning of it from day one. And so when they built Building 1, when we did, of course, there was the purchasing of the land and then the designing of the buildings. And I wasn't really a designer, although I did say, oh, this is ridiculous waste of space when we're doing a hallway here, so we can take this out and make the kitchen and living room open, which we did. But and that's another story in itself. But when they built Building 1 and Building 2, we weren't ready to move in. And although we had put down several thousand dollars to hold a space for us, and then Larry had a very traumatic experience, 2010, mm-hmm. But she had a head injury and wasn't expected to live. And that's another story, too. But when they built this building, then they said, okay, you need to move in or ask for your money back. No, it would be building 3. You need to ask for your money back or move in or take out your money or donate it to Raven Landing. Well, at that point, we still had medical bills on Larry's accident to pay for, so we needed the money, so we withdrew it. And then when they built Building 4, I was in a place where I was not feeling sick, but there's something wrong. I do not feel ill, but there is something wrong. And so, gosh, for 12 years almost, I had gone to the doctors and I'd say, something is wrong, I'm not myself. I don't feel like myself. And I was complaining about pain in my bone, especially in my leg bone. And so I went to a doctor and he said, oh, you have a hip replacement, the pain will go away. And I thought, gosh, that was a quick decision. I think he wants to purchase a new Mercedes too quickly. So I went to another doctor and he said, well, yes, I think you'd be rid of the pain if you had the hip replaced. And they also told me, well, you'll be in a wheelchair by summer if you don't have the hip replaced. And I thought, gosh, I can't get on a tour bus in a wheelchair. So I let that first doctor influence me and had the hip replaced in January of 2007, but the pain didn't go away. So I went back to the surgeon and I said, but I still have that pain. And he said, well, I don't see a reason to go in there and explore. I said, I won't let you go in there and explore. But it'd be so painful that it'd wake me up during the night sometimes. And so I knew something was still wrong. And I'd have Larry, it got to a place where I could no longer drive. And so I'd have Larry drive me to urgent care. I'd say, there's something wrong. And I don't feel sick, but there is something not right. So they said, well, I can't find anything wrong. And so he said, if you're not better, come back next week. So Larry took me back the next week, and I had a different doctor. And he concluded I had myalgia. And so you'll just have to live with that. And that's what's causing your pain in your bones and muscles. But I was no longer able to walk. I mean, I used to do marathons. I instigated the hiking division of the Fall Equinox Marathon, and that's another story too. But I would do marathons and 5Ks, and but I couldn't even walk a half a block with my walker. And so thanks to Diane Darnell, who was in charge of our Senior Olympics, which both Larry and I have participated in over the years, she said, if you have high calcium levels, well, it was interesting because she's the one that had said, if you have high calcium levels, check into parathyroid.com. And I my first thought was, how would I know if I had high calcium levels? And that's one of the symptoms of parathyroid disease, is your memory is blurry. And then it hit me one day, well, yes, I've had blood tests taken for the last 12 years for sure. So I pulled them out. All of them showed I had high calcium levels. And yet no doctor here was concerned about it. So I looked up on parathyroid.com and online, and there's my symptoms. Do not feel ill, but do not feel like yourself. Your spouse says you're bitchy, and that was true too. Your memory is foggy. You have high your blood pressure yo-yos, which it did. Sometimes it go 200 and over 100. My doctor says I'm not going to do anything about it because sometimes it's only 100 over 50, which is true. But there was a symptom of it. So I said to my doctor, I said, I'd like to have you order a parathyroid disease. Parathyroid hormone test, it's called. So he ordered it. He said, I'm not concerned about your high calcium levels, because all women your age have high calcium levels. Larry took me over to the lab. We had the blood drawn. I waited for my results. 30 to 50 is considered normal. Mine was 500. And so I came home and read that again on the line, and it says, if you are on calcium and vitamin D and you have high parathyroid hormone, stop both immediately. So I stopped both immediately. And then I made copies of my blood work and sent it to the clinic in Tampa, Florida, where they have, the general hospital has one, 6 floors just dedicated to parathyroid disease, and that's all they do. They have 12 surgeons that do nothing but parathyroid disease, and the disease is caused by a tumor on one of your parathyroid glands. And so the only way to get rid of the disease is to get rid of that tumor. And so it's a 15-minute procedure, and this is great. So I went in. My surgery was scheduled for the morning. When I came to in the recovery room, I realized it's afternoon. Okay, so where did these last several hours go? And there wasn't anyone to ask then, because as soon as I regained consciousness, they have you bust off to your hotel. And so when I got there, I took a nap. And when I woke up, I said, Larry, I feel ready to go to have dinner. So we did. The shuttle took us to dinner. And when we finished dinner, I said, I think I'd like to rock back to the hotel. Oh, he says, can you walk that far? I said, well, I don't know, but I'd like to try. And if I can't, we'll just have the shuttle pick us up wherever we are. So it was one block from the restaurant down to the river, and then 3 blocks up the river, and then a block back to the hotel. And as I was walking, I said, I feel like I'm having to walk all over. My legs feel like they're not mine. And I said, and the pain is gone. And when I got back to the hotel, I said, I feel like I've been walking better now than I have for ages. And Larry says, yes, you're right. When we got back to Alaska, then I called, we had 3 surgeons, and this is a little interesting aside too. They each came in and spoke to me individually. And the first one came in and he says, well, 84, you certainly belie your age. You don't look like 84. Of course, that's 2 years ago now. And then I said, well, thank you, doctor. And then the second one came in and says, oh, I can tell you're very active. And I said, oh, that's has been. I used to do marathons and 5Ks, and I can't even walk half a block with my walker now. He said, once we get this tumor out, you'll be doing 5Ks again. Well, we'll see. And then the third doctor said, Ruth, your blood work shows that you've had this disease at least 12 years. It was slowly killing you. But I think it was gotten to a place where it was fast killing me, no longer slow. And he said, we've never seen anyone with the disease for 20 years because we think it kills them before that. Well, and so I have, you know, I'm a miracle. So Larry's a walking miracle, too, and that's another story which he didn't share with you. But when I got back to Fairbanks, then I called one of those physicians, and I said, I was in there over 3 hours, wasn't I? He said, Ruth, I don't have your paperwork in front of you, and that surgery was last week, but yes, you were in there over 3 hours. You had one of the largest tumors we had ever seen, and it had attached itself to your thyroid gland, so we had to shave it off of the thyroid gland as well. And I said, well, I noticed that the incision goes beyond my Band-Aid. He said, yes, because it was a large tumor, we had to enlarge the incision. And if it bothers you, just put on a bigger Band-Aid. So that's what I did.
So happy.
And so I am a new woman, quite literally. Yes. Quite literally.
And so during that time, is that when you made the decision to move into building 4?
Yes. Well, it was just before I discovered it was parathyroid disease. That's when we decided, okay, I'm going downhill. And Larry has his problems too. And so I wanted him someplace where he would have other people around him, where he'd have some meals and not have to prepare all of his meals. And so that was what the decision was, even though it was financial. So we had to do some juggling of funds. But that's what brought us here. But I had gotten a place where I had, and what Larry says, I won't know how to handle things when you're gone. So I had typed up a list of things, what he's to do if I die at home, what he's to do if I die at the hospital. I had written my obituary.
Wow.
And so that's all done. But right now, today, I don't feel like I need it.
No, I don't think so.
2 years ago, I thought so.
So how do you find your experience here at Ravenland?
I find that I can be busy, too busy if I choose to be. There's never a dull moment. People say, how do you do? Help me, what do you do? Well, I have so many things, a lot of volunteer work in the community. So I'm out of the building a lot. But when we first moved in, and they had a session where they met with us, and telling us about the various, how things worked in the building and so forth. And they said, well, want somebody that's up early to unlock the front door. And then you can deliver the newspapers for the Newsminer to the subscribers. Larry, would that be you? And he says, no, that wouldn't be me. Ruth is the early bird. And I said, yes, I'm usually up at 5:30. Oh, well, you don't have to deliver the paper that early. Well, if it's there, but it's not there. But I do open the building when I get up every morning and deliver the newspapers to the people in the building that subscribe. And then there's Tai Chi. We both take involved in that. And they started a harmonica group here, so we play in that. And but there's never a dull moment if we don't want it to be a dull moment. Now, you can have your own privacy. You can lock your door. And
that would not be you. So you found it to be a really good experience.
Yes. Yes, and you can have your own things here, as much space, you know. We still have our house, because Larry really thought that when I was gone that he would move back out there. But we also have a son who wants to retire to Alaska. He has a job in Spokane, Washington, and misses Alaska very much. So his dream and his wife's, they plan to retire in 4 years now, and so he'll have the house to retire to if they choose to do that.
So you have a plan. That's a good plan.
We have a plan. And it was nice that I didn't have to move everything out right away and make that decision. Although, as I told my son, I said, I am downsizing. I am getting rid of things. And he says, Mom, you have a long ways to go.
Yeah, I know.
And he's right, because both Larry and I are collectors.
Yeah, I know how that is. So we have a fun and final question. What was your favorite age and why?
Oh, favorite age. There's none that I would want to return to and redo.
I have some nice memories.
I have some negative childhood memories too. Of course, my fondest ones is Larry's and my wedding.
Uh-huh.
And then because I do, I am a researcher, and one of my passions is genealogy, which I took up at the age of 9. Again, that when I made set my goal to come to Alaska. And when I think about it, I don't know if other people set their goals at 9 and follow through on it or not. But one of the things we had to do in Alaska when I was in Iowa, as a 10-year-old, in 6th grade actually, we were required to study Iowa history. And we had a little book that I'm sure was published in the 1800s. It was on the state history of Iowa. And it had talked about the Red Rock Line, which is a line that goes north and south from Missouri to Minnesota, and between the Mississippi River and the Red Rock Line was open to settlement for white settlers. But beyond that was Indian territory until 1847. And when that was opened up and the Indians were ushered out and white settlers could go on, the first home built by a white settler west of that Red Rock Line was built by Daniel Hunt. And it had a picture of a cabin, very nice looking cabin with a chimney was rock, you just saw it was an outside shot. And I knew my mother was a Hunt. So I went home and I said, is Daniel Hunt any relation of ours? And she said, well, yes, he would be your great-great-grandfather. Well, that sparked the interest. And so usually every Sunday we'd go down to visit the grandparents. But I'd take my line and writing paper and my pencil, and that was before the days of ballpoint pens. And I'd say, Grandpa, who was your mommy and daddy? When were you born? How did you meet Grandma?
Make it a tree.
And but I didn't know about it. In fact, somebody would say, oh, you're interested in genealogy. I'd say, yes, I like rocks.
Genealogy. Didn't even know the word.
That's right. I didn't even know the word genealogy. But that's how I got started. And then I've been asked to teach the class several times for local groups here at the university. I did one years ago when we... And it was how to do trace your family history by correspondence. That's before we had computers and all that. Now I teach it with using computers and totally different lesson plans, of course. But
so you've had a lot of life experience.
I have. And so as a result, that brought some travel, which I enjoy. And so I've done, and one of my goals, I like history and Alaska history. And so I'm on the state board of the Alaska Historical Society. But one of my goals is to visit someplace new in Alaska each year. And I haven't always succeeded in doing that. And, of course, that goal didn't happen until my later years when I had some funds to do it.
Sure.
So, but I worked for the Census Bureau, so I was into many of the villages doing interview work. And then I've taken tour groups to places like Nome. I've been to Nome, yes, but the tour groups, I've been to Barrow and Fort Yukon, and then Larry and I floated the Yukon River from Dawson down to Eagle when they had their centennial. And so we've gone every place we can go by road, and a few places that I can go by airplane or
well,
boat.
Well, it sounds like you've had a lot of fun in your life and have
so
still
continued
today. So.
Yes.
I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for inviting
me. It's been really fun to learn more about you.